This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's the forecast. There's a big chill in the air. It started settling in across broad areas of the country last month, leaving the nation's workforce nearly frozen in place. And the economic outlook heading into the new year is downright frightful. Blame it on something we'll call the job chill factor. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Marketplace entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal, who's away on assignment. Glad to have you with us on this Friday, the 4th day of January. And as of today, all bets are off. The government's report of weak job growth last month has changed the outlook of many economists. Up to now, the number of new jobs had been growing at a relatively healthy rate, and experts have been relieved that that was giving us some economic wiggle room. But now the job market has tightened up. Unemployment hit a two-year high last month, and the debate today focused on whether it may be too late to head off a recession. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
The Labor Department says the unemployment rate hit 5% in December. That's the highest number of jobless claims since December of 2005. Back then, the nation was recovering from Hurricanes Rita and Katrina. This new report is packing the punch of a hurricane in some financial circles. Mark Zandi's chief economist at MoodysEconomy.com. Like most of his peers, he was expecting weak numbers, but he was blown away by the job losses that hit diverse industries and regions.
No way to put any sugarcoating on this. The economy is, if not in recession, pretty darn close.
Zandi says the subprime mortgage mess and subsequent credit crunch may be catching up with us. He says the Federal Reserve needs to be more aggressive and cut interest rates by 0.5%. But that may be too little, too late. Michael England's with Action Economics. He fears the jobless figures could create a negative self-reinforcing cycle. He says that cycle may already be affecting the gross domestic product, or GDP.
Most of the slowdown in GDP up till now probably doesn't reflect reduced demand for goods. It reflects increased caution by business managers who fear we're going into a downturn.
But not everyone believes these jobless numbers signal doom for the economy. Richard DeKayser's chief economist with National City Corporation.
I don't think a recession's in the cards for 2008.
DeKayser says the main reason for the downturn is the housing sector. He says that's likely to stabilize and improve later this year, and that might be enough to help us sidestep a recession. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
There was obvious concern at the White House today as President Bush huddled with the Fed chief, his Treasury secretary, and other top economic advisors. Bush insisted financial markets and the economy are on solid ground, but he might yet offer an economic stimulus package later this month. The president spoke of new signs that require diligence. You can read that not just from an economic perspective, but a political one. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer how these growing recession fears might affect the looming presidential election.
If there's a recession, will the populists become more popular? Democrat John Edwards and Republican Mike Huckabee paint themselves as one of us. So Jordan Lieberman of Campaigns and Elections magazine says they might pick up traction.
the two Americas and the lost middle class. Absolutely, that message resonates across America.
Lieberman says some Democrats will customize that message.
And you're going to see certainly Barack Obama talk about the mortgage crisis and the recession and how families are struggling.
And remember, it's the economy, stupid, from Bill Clinton's campaign? Hillary Clinton is likely to take a page from her husband's playbook. Huckabee is the only populist Republican so far, although some critics say his national sales tax proposal would hurt the poor. American University political science professor James Thurber expects Mitt Romney to keep highlighting his management experience.
He sort of looks like a CEO. I think this hurts him with the common man when he goes out and says, I'm going to help you get your jobs back.
Republicans John McCain and Rudy Giuliani may avoid the R word, but Harvard economist Robert Lawrence says whoever wins won't really steer the economy.
Getting out of a recession depends far more on what the Federal Reserve does with interest rates than anything the government can really do in the short term, no matter who's in charge.
Still, no candidate is going to be stupid enough to ignore the economy. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The government of Kenya said today it would be ready to accept a court-ordered rerun of a disputed election that sparked a wave of violence. Opposition protests subsided in that African nation today, but the turmoil is still sending economic ripples across the region. Reporter Gretchen Wilson is monitoring the situation from South Africa. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What does Nairobi look like now? And there have been concerns about the country, the economy in particular, grinding to a halt there. What about the situation today? Improved? About the same? Worse?
The situation today has improved. There was a lot of concern that the ghost town of Nairobi would continue today. Yesterday, shops were boarded up and closed. Business tried to get off much as usual. Some shops and businesses have reopened. The stock exchange was open today, though volumes are pretty low and the shares continue to trade downwards. There was a lot of concern that this may signal a downward spiral for Kenya. So the biggest news today is really the ongoing shutdown of the transportation routes, which is making it difficult to trade.
What about the fuel for that economy, quite literally? And we're talking about not just the economy in Kenya, but for the region here. We know Mombasa is a major oil port for Rwanda, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Is this import stoppage affecting those areas?
Absolutely. The problem is that with this kind of violence, fuel has really been stuck there for days. So what's happening is in the entire region, well beyond Kenya's borders, gas stations are running dry. For example, in Uganda, there are major lines at the gas stations. And in Rwanda, they've started fuel rationing, and that's applying not just to private cars but to taxis. And so since so many people depend on these minibus taxis to get to work, it's meaning that people are actually having a hard time getting from point A to point B. And, of course, the slow transport not just affects people, it affects commodities. And so commodities are not getting to where they need to go. At the same time, it's even affecting jet fuel. So, for example, in Burundi, there's a shortage of jet fuel, and that's happening at the Burundi airport.
Well, let's talk about the commodities that you mentioned. How is this affecting the region agriculturally?
I know that there's reports now that in Uganda's capital of Kampala, the price of corn has shot up 30% in the last few days because there's a shortage of gas. And with a shortage of gas, you can't get corn to markets.
How could this play out if things don't resolve quickly?
Well, if things don't get resolved quickly, I think we're going to see more and more food price hikes in the region. And that's, of course, going to affect average people who may have nothing to do with the political situation. I don't know really how long this is going to last. No one really knows how long it's going to last. But if it were to continue in the long term, and in the worst case scenario, this were to spark long-term economic instability, it could mean that people will turn elsewhere for their goods. And that could actually have major ramifications for a place like Kenya.
Reporter Gretchen Wilson in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The stock market took a look at those disappointing employment numbers today and came up with some even worse numbers of its own. The details when we do the numbers. Have you seen those instant tax refund signs in the windows of tax preparation outfits like H&R Block and Jackson Hewitt? They offer to get your tax refund back to you early. What they're really offering is a loan, often a very costly one. Tax preparers and their bank partners have been making a ton of money off these so-called refund anticipation loans for years. But consumer groups say these loans are a terrible idea that ought to be banned. And now the Internal Revenue Service just might be swinging over to their side. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli has the story.
The Consumer Federation of America's Jean Ann Fox says refund anticipation loans have a long rap sheet.
They are extremely expensive. They're unnecessary loans that drain money out of the pockets of the working poor. And they are risky because the loans are secured by your expected tax refund.
And if that refund is denied, you end up with a loan to pay. Fox says the Internal Revenue Service now worries that big profits from these loans are encouraging shady behavior.
It gives tax preparers an incentive to encourage larger requests for refunds because then they can make a larger loan. According to the IRS, it encourages fraud and causes problems in the tax system as well.
So the IRS is seeking public comment on changing the rules. But consumer groups cite another problem. Low-income taxpayers who get the earned income tax credit are targets. The credit's a type of welfare payment to the working poor. But huge numbers who get it also take out refund anticipation loans. Ed Mirzwinski at the U.S. Public Interest Research Group says tax preparers smelled that new flow of money.
That has caused the tax preparation companies to change their business model to go after lower-income consumers and skim a large fee off the top in the form of a refund anticipation loan.
How large a fee? Consumer groups say that for the last year measured, 2005, low-income taxpayers alone coughed up $649 million for these loans, all for money that was usually coming soon anyway. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Jay Leno has been writing his own jokes for The Tonight Show this week, but he's bombing with striking Hollywood writers. The union claims he's violating strike rules. NBC insists the old contract makes an exception for material written by the person who delivers it on the air. Some writers are spending time away from the picket lines, delivering their own punchlines. Earlier this week, we sent Marketplace's Jeff Tyler to a comedy benefit for those who work behind the scenes in Hollywood.
After being out of work for 2 months, writers are milking their strike experiences for comedic material.
You ever drive by any of these picketers outside, you know? I think this strike is saving some lives because some of these guys look like they haven't had any daylight or exercise in 20 years.
That's Jeffrey Ross, a stand-up comic and a striking writer.
I lost a $25,000 writing gig today because of the strike. I'm here at the Laugh Factory making $4.
His performance at the Laugh Factory on Sunset Boulevard was part of a benefit, not for writers. No, the money raised went to help the so-called below-the-line workers, the gophers, gaffers, and grips who toil behind the scenes. The strike has cost more than 10,000 people their jobs and more than $1 billion in lost wages. TV writer Bill Taub helped organize the benefit.
When a television show goes down, 300 people are out of work.
And these workers aren't rich, says Jamie Masada, who owns the Laugh Factory.
Some of them, they make $8 an hour. The cleaning crew, the gophers, the security guys. The security guys, they make $9 an hour.
He's donating revenues from the door on Wednesday nights to help people like Kim Thorpe. For the past 25 years, she's worked in craft services.
We are the extra boom person. We help the grips. We help the electricians. Pretty much any department, we fill in and help them out.
Working on the Fox TV show How I Met Your Mother, she made a good living. She didn't anticipate going weeks without any income.
I just didn't think about the bills because I had a paycheck every week. You just got a bill, you paid it. And all of a sudden, I had all these bills and no paycheck.
She says many of her colleagues are struggling.
The extras who don't make a lot of money, they make $40 a day, $60 a day. They would come and they would work 2-3 days on our show. They counted on those 2-3 days, and now they've lost their jobs.
For financial help, many are turning to the Actors Fund, a nonprofit that assists anyone in the industry, providing grants to help with expenses. Keith McNutt is Western director of the fund. He says since the strike began, demand has increased steadily.
We would give out anywhere between $10,000 and $15,000 a month before this. Now we're averaging about $10,000 a week. The week before Thanksgiving, we prevented 3 evictions, 1 foreclosure, and 1 car repossession.
The fund bailed out Kim Thorpe when she didn't know where else to turn.
They helped me with my mortgage and my utility bill, and they gave me $100 towards my phone bill.
Things have gotten so bad for Thorpe, she's thinking about changing careers. The Actors Fund runs programs to help people like Thorpe retrain. Thorpe's worried the strike could stretch on a lot longer. tired of all the drama, she's thinking about getting into the restaurant business. In Hollywood, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson in Dallas. And David, do I hear you breathing on the other end of the line here?
You hear me breathing. You hear me under my breath saying, I'll take 2007 again, but so far this 2008 business is, is for the birds.
Sharpest decline in nearly a year for the NASDAQ is the handwriting on the wall.
Well,
here?
Now that thing was engorged. I mean, the worst thing, the worst thing is my birthday was July the 28th, and this is the worst overall week for the market since July 28th.
Oh, well, my birthday is today, so...
See? Maybe, well, happy birthday.
I guess I get to market in a not-so-great way here, huh?
Happy birthday. The NASDAQ was down 4%, the Dow fell 2%, and this one, Bob, this one was different. I mean, this one, we started out the other day, the first trading day of the year was just miserable. It was down, I don't know, about this, 220 points or something, and they said it was because of the ISM, the Institute for Supply Management's Manufacturing Index, which showed weakness in the economy and maybe leading to a recession. But the fact is, that one, I understand, that one was a lot of, just a lot of selling that was because they finally got the gains into the new year. People didn't want to pay tax last year, and they had gains, and they'd made this covenant going back to 1999 when everybody got burned, and they said, oh, please, let me just carry this gain into the new year, and I promise I'll take it.
Yeah, you can explain that all away, but you can't explain this one away, huh?
Now, this one just doesn't go away. I mean, this one was just, this one was ugly. The employment numbers were ugly. There's nothing magic about it. We've been worse than that. And the thing's probably going to get revised in a month. But, that really, a 5% unemployment rate kind of catches your attention.
Yeah, we hope revised in the right direction, right?
Yeah, exactly. But, all of this adds up. And so what you can get is sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy is that, you have enough people talking about a recession and you think about a recession. And by golly, you can slip into a recession. And you think about it, Bob. The life of a CEO nowadays is like 5 years, maybe 7 years. Well, we haven't had a recession in so long. We've got a whole crop of CEOs running companies right now, public companies, private companies, other companies, that have never operated in a recession. And you don't know. I mean, they may freak.
Did you hear anything reassuring today at all for the markets?
Yeah, we might not go into a recession. They may be wrong. There was that. And I know I mentioned this a month or two ago, but I think it's worth repeating, which is the market doesn't necessarily have to get killed or actually even go down in a recession. Of the 10 recessions we've had over the last 60 years, the Dow's lost ground in four of them and gained ground or broken even in six of them.
Yeah, okay, I'll buy that. But the question is, will anybody else?
Well, we can float it and try it.
Yeah. Thank you, David. David Johnson in Dallas. Coming up, families write their values down on paper for the generations to come.
It's sometimes good to pull it out and say we really do have a mission, and it's a great reminder of what we're trying to accomplish.
But first, let's do the numbers. If it wasn't so hard to say plummeted on the radio, we'd use that word. Let's just say the Dow Jones Industrial Average flopped almost 2% or 256 points to close at 12,800. The NASDAQ tumbled 3.75% or 98 points to close at 2504. The S&P 500 slashed 2.4%, 35 points to end the day at 1411. For the week, the Dow finished down 4.2%. The NASDAQ crashed 6.5%. The S&P 500 lopped off 4.5%. Home builders felt the kiss of the wrecking ball today. KB Home was gutted 7%. D.R. Horton sawed off more than 10%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. President Bush visits an elementary school in Chicago and talks about No Child Left Behind. Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert are scheduled to resume their TV shows without any writers. And passengers flying out of Heathrow and other select British airports will now be able to take two pieces of carry-on luggage onto the plane. Officials are relaxing a single carry-on restriction put in place in August 2006. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. Life after The Sopranos hasn't exactly been bada-bing for HBO, but it's been okay. Looks like all those people who might have dropped their subscriptions after The Sopranos left the air decided to stick around. HBO's crime drama The Wire kicks off its final season on Sunday night. Commentator Michael Schaefer says, for a police show, The Wire has an awfully good grasp of economics.
In the first scene from the new season of The Wire, a West Baltimore drug dealer is complaining about the cost of wholesale. Just pay your people less, the local kingpin tells him. One scene later, city cops are also grousing about money. Thanks to a city budget crisis, they're not getting overtime and can't even get their rattletrap police cars repaired. And just a couple scenes after that, the media types who are supposed to watchdog both cops and robbers are gossiping about cutbacks. When their editor complains that they got scooped on a story about bus service reductions, he's reminded that they haven't had a transportation reporter since the last round of buyouts. So things are tough all over. Welcome to the world of The Wire, the panoramic HBO series that enters its fifth and final season Sunday night. Starting with an ambitious West Side drug dealer and the detectives trying to bring him down, The Wire has sprawled in a way that looks a lot like a city's own map. Over the years, its plot lines have encompassed Baltimore's struggling dockyards, its gentrifying real estate market, its crumbling schools, and its Byzantine political scene. This season draws in yet another endangered civic institution, the daily newspaper, in this case the Baltimore Sun, which happens to be series creator David Simon's alma mater. But as much as it's an exercise in social portraiture, The Wire is also a show about economics. Specifically, it's about an old industrial city navigating the new economy. One minute, Marlo Stanfield is out to secure an independent supply line for his drug empire. The next, the Sun's trying to use a shrinking staff to cover the bodies in Marlo's wake. And then it's on to Mayor Thomas Carchetti, who's desperate to squeeze enough money from the tax base to stop, or at least solve, some of those killings. It's a reminder that all of us live in the same complex economy. Like the stick-up man Omar said, money ain't got no owners, only spenders. The dramatic part in the real-world economy, as in the HBO show, is the scramble over just who gets to do that spending.
Michael Schaefer is working on a book about another realm of the economy, pets. He lives in Philadelphia. Send us your thoughts at marketplace.org. Click on Contact. Ah, the heady days of early January. I hereby resolve to save more, spend less, finally fix that pesky, the heck with it. Anyway, resolutions aren't just for New Year's anymore. These days, they're taking the form of family mission statements, especially among the rich. They're like corporate mission statements, except they're about what to do with family wealth and handing down the right values to future generations. Sean Cole is a member of the Marketplace family. He has our story.
The whole idea of family mission statements isn't so new. Uber-rich families like the Hearsts and the Rockefellers were writing them in the early 1900s. What is relatively new is that family wealth management firms are now helping their clients write these things, even suggesting it, sometimes to prevent squabbles, sometimes to tell the heirs what's expected of them, and sometimes to focus their philanthropy.
Giving together is essential to our family, and we want it to continue for generations. We also hope to learn.
Jeffrey Scheck's family sold their restaurant supply business a few years ago for a lot of money. He wouldn't say how much. And as they set up their charitable funds, they drafted a three-paragraph statement saying they wanted to support Jewish causes and cultural organizations in their city. He says the process was a bit painstaking.
We just talked about each sentence, what does each word mean, made changes.
But the result can be really affirming.
It's sometimes good to pull it out and say we really do have a mission. and it's a great reminder of what we're trying to accomplish.
In fact, Sheck says his family is thinking of writing a more general mission statement about the values they want their kids to have, working hard, achieving excellence, which is more common. Also, about 80% of the wealth in this country was created within the last generation. And while it's hard to sympathize, getting rich can be scary and complicated for a lot of families. So in struggling for a foothold, some families might say,
oh, look, here's something I recognize from my business experience, a mission statement. I can do that with my family and everything will flow naturally from it. And it's not so.
Keith Whitaker helped the Shecks with their mission statement. He's the director of family dynamics at Caliber, a division of Wachovia. He says a lot of his job is helping nouveau riche families get along and not squander their money.
And so a family mission statement can be a focal point for working on some of those other things, but it's not an end in itself.
He showed me a couple of other examples that dealt with handing money down.
Dear children, in recent years we've had progressive discussions about my plans for transferring some of my assets to you.
So couldn't they just say that to their kids? You know, I mean, do they need to write it down like that?
But again, you got to take the big picture view that this is also a statement for generations that they may not meet. It's also like an anchor in the family so that you don't have to come back to saying the same thing over and over again, but you can kind of refer back to the document.
Frankly, it sounds like pretentious bullshit to me.
This is John Gasperi. For a lot of years, he was a quality management guru, helping companies serve their customers better. He used to joke about using quality improvement techniques on his family, as in this passage from his fictional essay, Quality Day at the Gasperis.
Say that I only had to assert my authority once by pointing out to my son that the words puke, scum, and scuzz tend not to show up very often in effective family mission statements.
He meant that as satire, thinking that corporate speak has no place in the living room.
It just feels so discordant to me that I don't. You might get a result that's approximately 180 degrees out of phase with what you're trying to get.
In that instead of happiness and being able to pass the values down, you
look silly.
Then again, neither Gasperi nor I, nor probably you, know what it's like to manage an awful, awful lot of money. And when you amass enough of it, the wealth itself becomes a kind of business.
Well, sure. It's got income that flows from the securities.
Again, family dynamics specialist Keith Whitaker.
It has a whole host of advisors and employees that go along with it.
Like you, for example.
Exactly, like our firm.
There are even corporatese terms that identify different subsets of rich families. Single wealth creator, sibling partnership, cousin consortium. So in that sense, family mission statements aren't too much of a stretch. And families like the Shecks seem to have the whole mission statement thing in perspective.
Unless you're showing and leading by example, I don't think they're worth the paper they're written on.
Hopefully the Sheck Cousin Consortium, Jeffrey's kids and nieces and nephews, will feel the same way. Maybe they should put that in their mission statement. I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, Hollywood's biggest seller of DVDs is taking sides in the high-definition DVD format wars. Warner Brothers has decided to partner exclusively with Sony to release high-definition DVDs in its Blu-ray format. It had previously backed both Sony and Toshiba's HD DVD technology, one of the few studios to do so. 20th Century Fox and Walt Disney already support the Blu-ray format. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 256 points, almost 2%. The NASDAQ plunged 98 points, 3.75%. The S&P 500 fell 35 points, 2.4%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Next time on the program, some college sports stars say they want sponsorships, not just scholarships.
You know, I like to see the money go up a little bit more. That way, we're not putting together a couple bucks just to go get a burger or something like that.
I'm Bob Moon. Thanks again for joining us. Kai's back Monday. Hope you will be too.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.